Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor speaking to Professor Nick Lloyd, a reader in military and imperial history at King's College London. His new book is The Western Front, The History of the Great War, Volume 1. We attend immediately to the larger-than-legend personalities of the four powers, Germany, France, Britain, and America as the final power. We begin with Germany because a man named Moltke, a man who is the relative of an earlier commander of German forces, is in charge of the Schlieffen Plan in August of 1914 in conversation with the Kaiser. And I learned from you, Nick, that the Kaiser favored Moltke, but Moltke was a man who was dealing with the ghosts of his ancestor and also of Schlieffen. What do we need to know about Moltke that he took it upon himself to alter the Schlieffen plan in the attack on Paris?
Yes, you've got the pressure on someone like Helmut von Moltke the Younger, that's his title, his full name, is enormous in 1914, and he's not up for it. He's a man that is, as you say, bowed down by the weight of victory that his uncle achieved in 1870 and 71 in the Franco-Prussian War. And he is, you know, he's concerned about the plan, the Schlieffen plan, envisages a massive attack through Belgium and the Low Countries that will essentially outflank the French frontier, the frontier fortresses the French have built, get the French army into the open and destroy it in a grand battle of envelopment. It's one of the most ambitious military plans you'll ever likely to see. But Moltke, you know, he feels very vulnerable and he feels quite insecure about having to do it, and ultimately doesn't have the nerve to actually put it into play in the way that Schlieffen envisaged, with that right wing, that sort of swinging door would be as strong as possible. So Moltke begins to alter the balance of forces. So he puts a little bit more force in the south on his left so that it's not going to be as powerful. And ultimately, he is already having doubts about whether this can be done, whether he can do it, what this is going to envisage. And so, you know, by mid-September, he's essentially been pushed aside because he's had a nervous breakdown. But I think early on in the book, you see the enormous pressures these people are under and the kind of steel and the kind of nerve you would need to perform well on something like the Western Front.
The Kaiser himself, Wilhelm, at various times he seems withdrawn or he's not ready for news. Other times he doesn't make decisions sharp enough, or he doesn't trust his generals. Did he change through the war, Nick?
I don't think he changes. I think his character, as you know, many historians have pointed out, he's like a weather vane. He moves. You know, he can be very committed to one thing one minute, and then the next minute he'll lose interest or he'll switch to a different position. So for those people around him, they'd never really know where he is and what he's thinking. And ultimately, although he's a sort of commander-in-chief in name, he's not really involved in the day-to-day war. He can make important interventions at times. He can sack generals. He can promote people. He can have the say on grand, you know, something like submarine warfare. But he's not in a day-to-day commanding role. But of course, as the war goes on and you get a number of people involved that become very, very well-known, particularly Hindenburg and Ludendorff from 1916, the Kaiser kind of shrinks. He becomes less, not less important, but as a figure, he becomes less of a figurehead and he becomes sort of in the shadows. And of course, he's quite insecure about all of this. And so he finds the whole war quite frustrating. And I think one of his early diary entries, he says to a friend, he says, well, you know, people think I command, but I don't. I just sort of, I go for walks and I chop wood.
Falkenhayn replaces Moltke in 1914. A man whom you identify as young for his post when he's raised up. He has steel. That's the only metaphor that I can think of in his backbone. What do we need to know about his vision of the battlefield?
Well, of course, you know, you've got this general sort of merry-go-round, and you see this through the book where certain generals become hired, fired. Some generals will do well, and they'll go, they get promoted, and then they'll fail, and they'll go back, and some even recover. Falkenhayn is a Prussian minister of war. So he's in an important position, and then he takes over from Moltke. And I think Falkenhayn is interesting for a number of reasons, but of course he's the architect of the Verdun Offensive, which is a battle which in some ways it sort of defines the Western Front, the battle that was fought predominantly to kill Frenchmen. There were no real territorial objectives. It was designed to kill the enemy in an attritional sense. So in some ways, Falkenhayn is quite a unique figure because most of the German generals, including von Moltke and including his successors, want to achieve a decisive battle based on maneuver. Falkenhayn doesn't really want to do that. And that's why I think Falkenhayn's an interesting character. And it also points to, I think, one of the great themes of the book, which is these different ideas about how you fight warfare that we get through different generals. Certain generals want to be more attritional. Certain generals want to be more maneuverist, want to be more based on mobility. And ultimately, nobody really knows what is going to be doable, if I can use that word, or what you can actually achieve on the Western Front, because it's such a, I call it a cauldron of war. It's such an intense exercise in violence that all these commanders are rapidly trying to work out what you can actually do in this new environment.
Bethmann Hollweg, the prime minister, I mention him because he is a man who's devoted to refusing Falkenhayn's wishes for unrestricted submarine warfare. Why did Bethmann Hollweg hold back, and how did he contribute to the troubles on the battlefront?
I think in Germany, you have quite a, the role of the politicians is, I think, quite significantly reduced or sort of lowered compared to the politicians in the West, in France and Britain. And those politicians, David Lloyd George, Clemenceau, they become more important as the war goes on. And they claw back some of the power that had been ceded to the generals in the early part of the war. I think with Germany, it's quite different. I think German politicians are in a weaker position, and the military hierarchy, the supreme command, have much more power, and they run the war. But of course, in terms of foreign policy, submarine warfare strikes at that quite deeply. So Bethmann Hollweg, I think, is in some ways, he shares a lot of the maximalist ideas about, Germany's role in Europe and what Germany can expect if she wins. But he's worried about a number of different things. They're worried about the Americans. They're worried about whether they can actually achieve submarine warfare. They're worried about the damage this will do diplomatically to Germany's reputation. So in some ways, it's a difference over tactics. Falkenhayn and others want to use every weapon at their disposal, whatever it might be, to the maximum that they can. And I think that's a great failing of the German military, we see both in the First and in the Second World Wars, is tactical and operational effectiveness is elevated far higher than it should be. Political, diplomatic, strategic issues are kind of relegated to a secondary position. And that ultimately is fatal to the German ability to translate battlefield success into strategic victory.
The book is The Western Front, History of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, Nick Lloyd. We've mentioned the German authorities, the people who will make decisions early in the war, and Nick mentioned Hindenburg and Ludendorff, who will enter in 1916, and we'll address those after the catastrophe of Verdun and Somme. However, we're going to turn to the French now, because as Nick's work explicates, the French participation in the war was outsized. The sacrifice was outsized. It was largely fought in France and Belgium, entirely here. All the suffering was in France. And the Versailles Treaty that ended the war is explained often as French revenge. You can see the basis of it as we watch the French fight the war against Germany that invaded France. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle. You'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.